It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we want to talk about the state of journalism in this country following this tumultuous election campaign. Of course, our founding fathers guaranteed a free press in the Constitution. The Bill of Rights is part of a system of checks and balances, also because they knew it was essential to have an informed citizenry, especially when it comes to voting. Republican candidate Donald Trump made a practice of criticizing the news media at his campaign rallies, even calling out some journalists by name, and that criticism was greeted by booing, jeering, and worse from the crowds. Here's Donald Trump at a rally in Scranton, Pennsylvania, the day before the election. It may be hard to understand, so I'll just tell you, the crowd starts shouting, CNN sucks.
Oh, boy. See the dishonest people back there, the media, the totally dishonest people. They are so dishonest. They are so dishonest, Fox. You can't even read articles in certain papers anymore. New York Times is a total lie. You can't. It is so false. Nothing to do with me. I'm just telling you. Such lies. Such fabrication.
Okay, Donald Trump the day before the election. And NPR political reporter Sarah McCammon was there for it all. She spoke with Trump supporters throughout the campaign, witnessed the Trump campaign's relationship with the media very close up, and she joins us for most of the hour. Sarah McCammon, welcome to the program.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm doing well. Of course, Sarah McCammon, a familiar name here on Iowa Public Radio, our former Morning Edition host and reporter here. And tell us, because you were involved, you were assigned to cover the Trump campaign for months. Tell us, first of all, what were your expectations going in to this based on what you'd heard before from others who'd done similar?
Well, I mean, my expectations going into this whole campaign were very different than, I think like most people, very different than the outcome. I was hired by NPR in the summer of 2015 to cover the Republican race with the understanding that I'd likely end up covering the Republican nominee, whoever that would be. And actually, Donald Trump was one of the first candidates I covered during the primary campaign in South Carolina in July of 2015. And I have to say, I went into that expecting not a lot. I think the conventional wisdom at the time was that Trump's run was just kind of a lark, that maybe it was an effort to boost his brand or get attention or who knows what, and that he wouldn't go very far. And I have to say, Ben, I was really stunned by the amount of enthusiasm for him in that crowd in South Carolina that first time I saw him. It was in a retirement community, and it was a packed house. This was like only a limited pool of people that could even come because it was a gated community kind of thing. And it was a packed house, an enthusiastic crowd. People were there with their signs. I saw it again in Iowa at the Iowa State Fair in August. Just anybody who was there probably remembers the coverage. There were, hundreds of people following Trump around the state fairgrounds and really enthusiastic. And it was like something I'd never seen before. So I don't know that I had any specific expectations for the relationship with the press other than, I think we all expected a very different kind of campaign than what happened.
Tell us specifically how that developed as you covered the Trump campaign more and more in regard to the news media. We just heard that clip of Donald Trump the day before the election with his claims against the media, more or less in collusion, he claimed, with the Hillary Clinton campaign. How did you experience that as someone following the Donald Trump campaign with him every day?
Yeah, well, I would say that it accelerated and intensified as time went by. And I think it's important to note that it is not unusual for politicians of both parties to criticize the press. And, that seems fair to a degree, right, that politicians are there to win over voters, to make their case. They're not always happy with the coverage they get. and they're free to say so. We heard, if you want to back up again, you know, earlier in the campaign, we heard Bernie Sanders often criticize, you know, his coverage by the press and put forward the idea that he wasn't getting a fair shake. I covered pretty much all the Republican candidates at one point or another, and this was a theme I heard a lot from Texas Senator Ted Cruz. There was a line in his stump speech that he would, you know, he would say, when he was elected, all these journalists and editors and reporters are going to have to check themselves into therapy. And he'd always get a big laugh from the crowd, you know, sort of tapping into that anti-media sentiment. And I think it does exist on both sides of the aisle. But I have to say that with Trump, it was more intense, more prolonged, and it got more intense as the campaign cycle went on. So I don't remember the first time I heard him criticize the press. I certainly was not at every rally. Far from it early on, because I was bouncing around different candidates. But, you know, when I started covering him regularly early in 2016, I do remember it being a standard part of his speech where he would say, you know, look at those disgusting reporters back there, and people would boo. But I can't say exactly when it turned, but it seemed that as time went by, it would become a more and more prominent feature of his speeches. It would become something that he would weave in and out of his speeches, often a theme he would return to again and again. And often the crowds would get more and more angry and more loud each time he returned to this idea of, you know, the press being part of the rigged system and the establishment that he was railing against. I do know that he singled out specific reporters fairly early on. I don't remember exactly which month, but I know NBC's Katie Tour was an object of his criticism and attacks early on, as was, of course, Megyn Kelly, Fox News' Megyn Kelly, as far back as the first debate. So this has been a theme of Trump's campaign, but at least from what I observed on the ground, it did feel like it was just something that became more and more a standard part of his speech. And it was almost like I would compare it sometimes to, you know, if you go to a rock concert and you're expecting certain hits, right? Like it may, there's just certain hits that you know that the singer is going to play because the audience loves them and is there to hear that. And it really kind of became part of the ritual. You know, we would even sometimes go into these events and, you know, at the very beginning be chatting with people, and sometimes they'd mention it, you know, that, you know, that, or it would come up in the conversation, at least, that there's probably going to be a point where, you know, we boo at you. And usually it just felt like it was kind of part of the shtick, but there were times that it felt honestly a little scary.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to play a little bit of tape, Sarah, that you collected here. Maybe you can set it up. This is a clip from a conversation you had with a man named Dean Boyles, a home remodeler from Hendersonville, North Carolina, certainly a believer that the media was colluding with Hillary Clinton's campaign. Anything else to say about it before we hear this short clip?
Let's just hear it.
Okay. Sarah McCammon in conversation with a Trump supporter.
Because they're a propaganda machine. They're going to drag that old hag across the line no matter what.
Did I hear you right? Did you really say the media is going to drag that old hag across the line? Is that what you said?
That's what I said. She can barely stand as it is, you know.
Okay, yeah. So that was typical. But was there a lot of go ahead.
A few weeks ago, you know, that wasn't long before the end of the campaign. And one thing I noticed about Trump supporters too is often they would pair it back to me things they were hearing from him, whether it was at the rallies or on, you know, through his surrogates on the cable networks. That idea that the media is going to, you know, drag Hillary Clinton, to paraphrase there, drag Hillary Clinton across the finish line, was an idea that Trump was pushing really hard the last month or two. Just that, you know, this, he was conflating this idea of a rigged electoral system with this idea of a biased media, and saying that, you know, basically the media were colluding with Hillary Clinton, and we're going to, you know, basically, you know, give her a win. At least some of his supporters felt that way.
What about what about the point at which Donald Trump, I guess, blacklisted some members of the media? Washington Post, the Des Moines Register also included. I don't know if that affected you or how many of your colleagues it affected, and how did it affect you?
Yeah, NPR never made that list. But you're right. I think the Des Moines Register may have been the first, or at least one of the very early ones, to be blacklisted after, I believe it was the editorial calling for Trump to pull out of the race. And then there were several others, a Politico reporter at one point, the Washington Post for quite a while. And from what I understand, a lot of those reporters would just go basically separately on their own. I mean, so typically the process you follow if you want to cover a candidate is, you know, you have to get credentialed by the campaign, and then you end up, you know, standing in this area called the press pen, which the Trump campaign had a lot of rules about. I mean, there typically is a press area at any political rally, but this one was very restricted. You couldn't go out of it at certain times, which made it often difficult to talk to voters. But what, like, some of my colleagues at the other outlets would do who were banned is basically just, you know, apply for credentials or apply for a ticket just as a civilian, sort of, and just go and wait in line and stand in line with the crowd, sometimes for a couple of hours, and end up, you know, inside there in the crowd. And I'm not going to mention any specific names since I haven't asked them, but I do know that some of them found that a really valuable experience to just be in amongst the people and, you know, spend all that time chatting with people. And I know there was at least one reporter who was usually people would be allowed in that way, but just not allowed to sit in the press area. But at least one, I think on one occasion, somebody was told to leave, even sitting with the main part of the crowd. So I think what you find is that, like, journalistic organizations had to get kind of creative about how to cover Trump. And but, you know, in this day and age, you know, Trump has used social media and the internet to get his message out. But it also means that it was really easy, even if he didn't go to a rally, you could watch him live online and know what he was saying. It's not the same experience as being there, but, you know, there's a lot you can cover from your desktop. It's not as good as actually being in the room. But sometimes that was how reporters would compensate, is just keeping an eye on what he was saying online. So
Sarah, I'm very interested in we hear a lot of vague statements from Donald Trump, but also from the supporters. Were there any specifics behind it? The condemnation of the press, specific instances brought up that Donald Trump said proved his point?
You know, it was more calling out specific reporters and organizations. I don't recall hearing a lot of specific indictments of particular stories. It was more just a broad sense that this, you know, the media is corrupt and in collusion with the Democratic Party, which, you know, I never heard Trump provide evidence of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was sort of a claim that seemed to resonate with his supporters, who I think had a real sense, you know, it fed into this larger feeling by a lot of Trump supporters I met, just that the system as a whole wasn't set up for them. It wasn't working for them, and there was sort of this division between the elite, the people in power, the people in government, and in the mainstream media, who were used to setting the agenda and calling the shots, and whether or not it worked for sort of the average working American. So there was a lot of anger toward the press. And, you know, in many ways, I felt like when we were at these rallies, we became kind of a stand-in for all of that. We were like, you know, everyone else in the room was there as a Trump supporter, and we were there as the press, as you know, neutral observers. And so we became, you know, kind of a punching bag, metaphorically.
Right.
A place to unleash all of this anger at the establishment. Never mind that a lot of the people in that press pen are 23-year-old you know, network embeds who were hired out of college to follow the candidate around all day long and are not, you know, whatever anger at the press there may be, valid or not, these were not the people who were calling the shots or making the big decisions about coverage. These were just the frontline troops on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Briefly, Sarah, how much access did you have to candidate Donald Trump? Did you have access? Could you ask him questions at any time?
Very little. He did not give a press conference. He never granted an interview to NPR, despite multiple requests. He did not give a press conference since late July. It was the last time he gave a full sit-down press conference where he actually took questions. I believe he took a couple of questions in Mexico after he met with Mexican President Peña Nieto. And I believe he did a brief, what they call a gaggle, which is sort of an informal, quick, you know, answer a couple of questions with a couple of reporters at one point since then. But, you know, a true opportunity for the traveling press that covers him to take questions, he did not do. He really curbed the number of national interviews he was doing in the last months of the campaign. I mean, most of the interviews he gave that were at least sit-down recorded interviews were to Fox News. And it seemed that he was, you know, minimizing opportunities for scrutiny. Now, certainly Hillary Clinton, had, you know, the same criticism. There was a long, long, long stretch there where she didn't do press conferences, although she started doing that again. Really, it was kind of funny. After a lot of criticism from the Trump campaign, it kind of flipped, and Hillary Clinton did several press conferences, and Trump stopped. So, you know, there were access issues for sure with both candidates, but I covered the Trump campaign. I was able to ask him over the course of the campaign, I think, three questions during press conferences, but that's about as close as I got.
Okay, Sarah McCammon, hang on. Sarah McCammon covered the Trump campaign for NPR. I wanted to include also Jesse Holcomb with us, Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center. Jesse Holcomb, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Ben.
Talking about trust in journalism or lack of trust in journalism these days in the aftermath of this tumultuous campaign. And, Jesse, I wanted to turn to you in the Pew Research Center to have you share a couple of studies you did looking at the attitudes of the modern news consumer, whether people trust information they get from a variety of sources, including what we call mainstream news media. You put out a report in July. What questions did you ask there?
Well, we wanted to gauge the public's broad sense of trust and confidence in news organizations, local and national organizations, as well as their trust in other sources of information like social media. And I would say, broadly speaking, we found that most people have at least some trust in the information coming from the media, but few people have a lot of trust.
Mm-hmm. And what other questions did you ask?
Oh, well, we drilled down into what's underlying some of those trust indicators,
mm-hmm.
and here are the verdicts somewhat mixed on what the media tends to do well in the eyes of the public. For instance, we asked whether people think that news organizations give rather keep political leaders from doing things that shouldn't be done. In other words, do they fulfill that watchdog role? And here we found that a pretty solid majority, 75% of the public, say that they indeed fulfill that role. However, we also found that about the same share of the public, 74%, say that the media favor one side. In other words, there's this sense among broad swaths of the public that the media are biased, and we found this to be especially true among conservative Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Now, in October, Pew looked at how the media should cover controversial statements by candidates, potentially offensive or inaccurate comments. What did you specifically look at there?
Well, in terms of the offensive comments, we asked registered voters at the time whether or not they thought the news media should emphasize a particular candidate's offensive statement or not emphasize it. And here we found an interesting split among Trump supporters and Clinton supporters at the time. Here we found that a pretty solid majority of Clinton supporters thought that it was the job of the news media to emphasize a candidate's offensive statement, but we saw something close to a pretty even split among Trump supporters on that particular issue. Now, we asked some other questions about what is the job of the media in covering this campaign at the time, and when we asked the public whether or not they thought the media should emphasize an inaccurate statement rather than an offensive statement. Here we found pretty solid majorities across the board. Whether you're a Trump supporter, whether you're a Clinton supporter, supporters of both candidates agreed in large numbers that the press should emphasize inaccurate statements. And we also found majorities thinking at the time that fact-checking is indeed the responsibility of the media, although we found that to be the case more so among Clinton supporters than Trump supporters.
Back to you, Sarah McCammon of NPR, on that fact-checking and the offensive statements. What kind of conversations did you have at NPR or did you think about when you were, you know, deciding which statements to cover of Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, I would point out that we did many, many fact checks throughout the course of the campaign. And I have to say that this has been, it's been a challenging election to cover because it seems like it's been very divisive and upsetting to a lot of people on all sides. And sometimes the press is really the focus of that anger. It's sort of the kill the messenger kind of thing. We heard from Clinton supporters who felt like we were giving a pass to Trump. We heard from Trump supporters who felt like we were shills for Hillary Clinton. I mean, we heard all of it. But when it came to fact-checking, we did multiple fact-checks of both major party candidates. We would live fact-check the debates, and that was a really successful project that our visual and digital teams came up with, starting with the first presidential debate. We basically got a live transcript as they were talking and marshaled a whole team of at least a couple dozen NPR reporters to bring their expertise in various areas to play and live fact-checked online as they were speaking. When it comes to putting, false statements on the air, it's challenging sometimes when there are multiple false statements in a row. This is part of why I think we don't tend to run rallies live, because it doesn't really allow much opportunity for context. But we would, we tried very hard to make sure that anytime, a soundbite was used or a quote was paraphrased, that if there was something untrue in it, that we provided context and push back on that a bit. And that was true for both candidates.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, you were with, we have to go to break in just a minute, but you were with a number of other members of the media there too, who had covered other campaigns. Did they react that this was completely different? This was your first time out with a major campaign, right?
Well, yeah, my sense was that at least in terms of access, it was very different. I mean, Trump, for instance, never rode on the press plane. There was a specific plane for the press that was chartered, for the national media. And he never once wrote on that. Hillary Clinton didn't at first, but eventually came around. But that was a big difference. It made access really difficult.
Okay. Sarah McCammon, I hope you can stay with us a few more minutes. I know you have to file for All Things Considered. You can stay a little bit after the break, right?
That's right.
Okay, excellent. Sarah McCammon, formerly of Iowa Public Radio, now of NPR, talking about her time covering the Trump campaign. Jesse Holcomb, I want to thank you very much, as Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center, for giving us some relevant information about what you've been looking at. Jesse, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Ben.
When we come back, we'll talk more about trust in journalism in the aftermath of this tumultuous campaign. Tell us what you're thinking. Do you agree with Donald Trump in his criticisms of the news media? Do you agree that there's some trust that needs to be recovered for news journalism? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, talking about the state of journalism, news media in this country following the tumultuous election campaign. And this hour, we're talking about trust in the news media and the charges that Donald Trump, now president-elect, made during the campaign against the news media, and what we might be able to do to restore any lost trust with the news media. I want to finish up our conversation with Sarah McCammon. She covered the Trump campaign for NPR for months, almost a year. Pretty much a year. Sarah McCammon joining us by phone. Sarah, before you go, and I know you have to get going to file for All Things Considered, we're looking forward to that report this afternoon. Donald Trump vowed during his campaign to change the libel laws to make it easier to sue journalists. I wonder, does that have any ripples there with the press corps that you're involved with at NPR? The implications of such a threat, whether or not he'll follow through with it, I guess we don't know.
I don't think so. I think we just keep doing what we've been doing, in the sense that, I'm not an expert on libel law, but my understanding is that there has to be both malice, intention to, smear someone, and also dishonesty, falsehood, and you know, those are things that our profession guards us against. You know, we have a deep commitment to fairness and to truth telling. And I think as long as we're doing those things, we should be just fine. I mean, I do think that this election is obviously cause for self-examination in, you know, in larger ways. You know, how well is, and not just NPR, but the press as a whole, you know, covering all of America and not just the big, you know, urban centers? How well are we, you know, anticipating and understanding what's going on in the country? But I think, you know, the polls were, they said what they said. And there's going to be a lot of soul searching, I think, among pollsters as well. And there are a lot of reasons why they were wrong. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when it comes to libel, that's not something I worry about a lot because, you know, regardless of who's president, it's my job to tell the truth and tell it as well as I can. And right. That's what I plan to keep doing.
What are your thoughts looking forward to Donald Trump, the way he treated the press during the campaign? And how might President Trump next year approach the White House press corps?
And it's been interesting watching the pool reports come in because, in case our listeners don't know, and I don't know why you would know, you know, there's a pool of reporters assigned to the president-elect and to the president at all times. It's considered sort of a constitutional necessity to know where the president is at all times. And right now, the pool that's covering Donald Trump has been staking out Trump Tower in New York, where he and his staff are preparing for the transition. And, you know, he hasn't given a press conference yet, and perhaps he will. But there have been reports go by that come into my email that suggest that, you know, the press isn't always sure exactly what he's up to or where he's going to go next. And we have been promised that there will be some kind of a, you know, a pool once he's elected. But I think there are big questions about, you know, how he will govern and how he will relate to the press. Will he provide access? Will he credential news outlets he disagrees with, or will he allow the credentialing of them for the White House press pool? You know, all of that remains to be seen. I think it's also worth noting that there's been a lot of criticism of the Obama White House for, you know, by the White House Correspondents Association for, you know, lack of access and transparency. So it's an opportunity if Trump wants to be a different kind of president, if he wants to be a very open and transparent president, you know, that would be a change, I think, in the minds of many reporters. But certainly the campaign he ran doesn't give us a lot of indication that that will happen, but we will see.
Okay, yes, indeed, we will see. Sarah McCammon, thanks for your coverage and for joining us this half hour. Sarah McCammon of NPR, thanks.
Thanks.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, talking about trust in the news media in the aftermath of this campaign. To finish up the hour, I want to talk with Margaret Sullivan. She's a media columnist with the Washington Post. The Washington Post, one of the news organizations targeted repeatedly by Trump during his campaign, one of those, I guess, blacklisted. Margaret Sullivan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit more about what the Washington Post perhaps experienced during this campaign.
Well, it was a few months ago, over the summer, that the Post was writing some fairly tough stories about Donald Trump, and as were other news organizations. And the Trump campaign decided to remove the credentials of the Washington Post so that its reporters were not able to get press access to his rallies and campaign events. So the Post was very far from alone in this. The Des Moines Register actually was part of the blacklisted group, as was, you know, BuzzFeed, everything from BuzzFeed to Politico to a number of local and national news organizations. So there was a fairly lengthy list. It did not stop the Post from continuing to cover the campaign. It just made it a little bit more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Margaret, you ended a recent column of yours writing, these are your words, "We've still got our precious First Amendment rights. Now it's time, high time, to protect them from the fire." Explain a little bit about what you wrote in that column, what you mean by the fire and the threat.
I'm concerned that based on what we've seen in the campaign, that the Trump administration could be a particularly tough one on press rights. And so when we talk about press rights, I think often people think, oh, you know, that's just for journalists. It actually, and I think we need to be able to get this across a little bit better, these are actually rights that the public has, and the press is intended to represent regular people, American citizens, when it covers events, when it writes about and keeps public officials on both sides of the aisle accountable. Donald Trump, you know, as you mentioned, through this blacklisting and through his inaccessibility, as Sarah was talking about, has been and I think will continue to be a particular challenge for those rights which come to us, which flow to us through the First Amendment. So there's real room for concern here, I think.
Mm-hmm. As Sarah also pointed out, it's nothing new for a presidential candidate to criticize the press, but it seemed Donald Trump took it to a new level. I want to get your reaction to this, Margaret Sullivan. Of course, this was, as Sarah pointed out, sort of like a best of hits. When you'd go to cover a Donald Trump rally, you knew there was going to be this part criticizing the press. Let's hear one here. This is not at a rally. This is Donald Trump speaking at a campaign rally in October of this year, where he was denying the allegations of sexual assault that were mounting against him. Again, it is actually at a campaign rally.
There are political special interests, no different than any lobbyist or other financial entity, with a total political agenda, and the agenda is not for you, it's for themselves. And their agenda is to elect crooked Hillary Clinton at any cost, at any price, no matter how many lives they destroy. For them, it's a war. And for them, nothing at all is out of bounds.
Okay, Margaret Sullivan, react to that characterization of the press, not out there to inform the people, but to take sides, in this case, to take sides and get Hillary Clinton elected.
So I know that a lot of people feel that the mainstream press, the mainstream media, was in favor of a Hillary Clinton presidency. And it is true that of all the newspapers in the United States, only two endorsed Donald Trump for president, and vast numbers of them endorsed Hillary Clinton. That is intended to be, and I think largely is, separate from the news coverage, which sets out to be fair and impartial. Now, Donald Trump didn't portray it that way, and there may have been instances when that wasn't the case. But the journalists that I know, and I've worked for a long time in Buffalo, New York, my hometown paper, and also at the New York Times and the Washington Post, do set out to be fair and to get it right. And I think that those characterizations are a kind of rhetoric that allows people to resent the press, and I find it destructive, because we actually have a very important role to play in our democracy, and I hate to see it eaten away at, which I'm afraid this does.
Margaret Sullivan is with us, media columnist with The Washington Post, for another 10 minutes or so. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's get to some listener comments and questions, Margaret, to have you react to. Tom is with us in Cedar Rapids, running out of time this hour. Tom, briefly, what's your question or comment?
Hi. Read this morning in U.S. Today Today, and I guess New York Times, that Mark Zuckerberg has finally admitted that there were a lot of false news stories posted, and that Facebook is going to start deleting false news items. And it also said that Facebook now is the primary source of news for Americans. Obviously, Facebook was not designed as a news outlet. It relies on people feeding it. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what the experts think about all of that.
Okay, well, we can hear from Margaret Sullivan about, so these emerging media, Margaret Sullivan, are becoming more and more news sources, even if they weren't originally intended to be so.
That's right, and I mean, that's a great question and a very perceptive one. Facebook never wants to think of itself as a media company. It wants to think of itself as a tech company, you know, that it's just a platform. And in fact, it doesn't have a news organization behind it. It doesn't produce news, but it sure distributes it. And it's hugely, hugely influential in terms of what people can come to believe, because the things that come across our news feeds and are in the trending topics are not decided by an editor or driven by accuracy or fairness or truth. They're only what people are engaging with the most. So if you're engaging, that is sharing a story that says that Pope Francis has endorsed Donald Trump, which was not the case, that story was shared nearly a million times on Facebook, and you can be sure that many people believed it, even though it wasn't true. So I think that Facebook and other social media organizations need to take some responsibility for dealing with this fake news, these hoaxes that are coming up that are really changing the way people understand what's going on. It's not their fault. This is what's coming across, and it's very hard for, you know, the ordinary person to know what's real and what's not real. So I think Facebook needs to face up to the fact that they're actually a media company.
Matt, one of our listeners on Facebook, makes this criticism. He says, can you blame people for not trusting the news outlets? NPR and IPR are no different, reading stories published in other sources with no credible evidence of your own. The way the pundits treated the Sanders campaign movement, he writes, was appalling. How do you read
it? I'd be happy to address that.
Yeah, do.
Sure. So, you know, I think there is a legitimate criticism of the media. And again, the media, it's such a broad name.
It's not a singular.
It's hard to know.
Yeah, it's a plural.
Well, no, it's not. I mean, are we talking about Breitbart or the Des Moines Register? Or are we talking about CNN or the National Enquirer or the Washington Post? So nevertheless, I think your correspondent has a point that the media writ large did fail to take Bernie Sanders' campaign as seriously as they should have. And, you know, they seemed to think that Clinton was simply going to be it, and they covered it that way. And Bernie Sanders had incredible passion behind his, you know, his crowds, his supporters had incredible passion, in the same way that we saw Donald Trump being able to tap into that really emotional core that people had and speak to their sense of being left behind or being disenfranchised. And I think that's a fair critique of the media, that they didn't really give Bernie his due.
Mm-hmm. Ben, one of our listeners, emails, why hasn't anyone addressed the connection of Trump and libel laws to fascism? It seems everyone is skirting around the subject. One of the classic symptoms of fascism is control of the media. Would you go that far, Margaret, with those worries?
Well, I don't think we're on the brink of fascism, but it is true that in autocratic societies, the first thing to go is a free press. And there are actually, you know, I don't want to seem alarmist, but there are some worrying signs here to me. You know, just yesterday, President-elect Trump named Steve Bannon as his chief strategist. Well, Steve Bannon has been the chairman of Breitbart News, which is a fringe right-wing media organization, which has printed a lot of lies and will function as kind of a propaganda arm for the White House. So it's not quite Pravda yet, but it does make you wonder how much something like that, which can distribute misinformation, is going to measure up against the independent press, which could be somewhat squelched under the Trump administration. So, you know, I think we have to really be on guard, and that's what I was writing about when I was trying to draw people's attention to the importance of the rights that are made explicit in the First Amendment. I think we need to be really vigilant.
We have about 5 minutes left with Margaret Sullivan of the Washington Post, columnist, media columnist there. Wanted to play a little bit more tape of Donald Trump speaking at a press conference in May of 2016, Margaret. Here, and this is being asked about what it would be like for the press under President Trump. He was candidate Trump here. Here he is after responding to questions about his donations to veterans organizations.
I think you've set a new bar today for being contentious with the press corps, kind of calling us losers to our faces and all that.
No, not all of you, just many of you.
All right, fine. Enough of us. Is this what it's going to be like covering you if you're president?
Yeah, it is. Let me tell you.
We're going to have this kind of confrontation in the press room.
Okay. Yeah, it is going to be like this, David.
And here are his closing statements on the subject from that same press conference.
I find the press to be extremely dishonest. I find the political press to be unbelievably dishonest. I will say that. Okay. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I say, Margaret Sullivan, what are your thoughts then going forward as the White House press corps gets ready to cover Donald Trump?
I think it's exactly what Sarah said, that the journalists have to do their jobs and do them better than ever. So we have to hold people who are powerful to account, and that, again, goes for both sides of the aisle, absolutely, and always should be that. But in this situation, we have to really have a stiff spine and know that it's not going to be easy and do the job that we're supposed to do for the citizens of the United States. And it's an absolute necessity that we not sort of buckle under pressure here.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about this connection with the public. For instance, what do we say to the people who are so disillusioned with what they call the mainstream press that they can't trust it? How do you regain that trust so that it functions the way our founding fathers intended it, that the free press would inform us and we would become an informed electorate?
You know, I think the only way to regain trust is by being scrupulously fair and accurate. And even then, it may not be easy to do at all, because you have people who are, you know, making a sort of a profession out of saying how dishonest, how unfair, and it's very hard. You know, you repeat that often enough and it seems to be accepted. I haven't found it to be true in my very long career as a journalist. Some of the best and most honest and people of most integrity I know are reporters and editors. I don't know exactly how to counter it except by doing our job as well as we can.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine then a very restricted, perhaps the most restricted press vis-a-vis the president in the future? Why would that have a problematic outcome when the president allows less access than previous presidents have?
Well, you know, I don't think that Americans want to live in a society in which there is essentially sort of a ministry of truth, where instead of having real photographers go and take photographs of what's going on, you get handouts from the essentially the propaganda arm of the White House. I think that citizens actually have to step forward and make it clear that this is something that they value and they want. And they can do that by making contributions to public radio. They can do it by subscribing to newspapers that they think are doing a good job. And they can do it by letting their elected officials know that this matters to them so that they can push back.
Mm-hmm. Going forward, we're just a week away from the election. Margaret Sullivan, we have just about a minute left. So do you think all the answers are there so far? Donald Trump just getting accustomed to being briefed and so forth and finding out the full implications of what it means to be president of these United States. Do you think the jury's out as far as how he will treat the media? What are your hopes? What are your fears?
Well, I don't think that we know exactly how that's going to go. He may turn out to be accessible. We know that he thrives on attention and wants good coverage. I think the worry comes when the coverage is not so good, which it can't be all the time. And if the Trump administration starts to blacklist or shut down or be inaccessible to those organizations that are trying to cover him in a aggressive, assertive, honest way, then I think we could run into some real trouble.
Okay, Margaret Sullivan, media columnist with The Washington Post. Margaret, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
This program is part of the Pulitzer Prize's Centennial Campfires Initiative, a joint venture of the Pulitzer Prize's board, the Federation of State Humanities Council, and Humanities Iowa, in celebration of the 2016 Centennial of the Prizes. The initiative seeks to illuminate the impact of journalism and the humanities on American life today, to imagine their future, and to inspire new generations to consider the values represented by the body of Pulitzer Prize-winning work. Support is provided by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Carnegie Corporation of New York, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Pulitzer Prizes Board, Columbia University, and Humanities Iowa. Tomorrow on this program, of course, it's Politics Wednesday. With us, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, and who else? Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. Hope you'll join us with your comments, your questions. Politics Wednesday tomorrow on the program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.